Today, we're going to talk about using PNI to find things out for research and discovery. And what I have written down here is we're going to talk about what we've learned about using PNI to discover insights and trends, how PNI connects to other ways of finding things out, such as qualitative and quantitative research, and ideas for designing PNI projects to find things out. So that's kind of like our experience, our ideas, and connections. Okay. Go.
Yeah, the first thing that struck my mind is, was there ever a PNI project somebody didn't find out anything?
Well, but yeah, that was my thought. I was actually thinking the same thing that this morning. I was trying to think about what did I have to say about this, and I think that in some ways, this is the, of the whatever it is, eight aspects that we're going to talk about, this might be the one that least can stand alone, because if you try to find things out, you're going to do a bunch of other things at the same time.
Yeah, but on the other hand, I've been thinking, if somebody charges or commissions a PNI project with the aim of finding things out, then the participants, by researching their own stories and patterns, like you write in the book, in any PNI project, somebody finds out something. But I think we should limit here to, does the customer get valuable insights that can be a replacement for traditional types of research? If you do an interview series or a survey, can a PNI project deliver results to a customer that is comparable to or different or better than traditional forms of research? That could be one of the things we talk about. Because the blog I wrote on PNI was about, I was a researcher and I started applying PNI type methods in my research as a replacement of the traditional interviewing method. And then it turned out, if you engage people as researchers of their own services, that you find totally new things. Because if you interview them, they are still able to keep up appearances, but as soon as they start talking to each other, wow, what was that?
I think that's my chair making a lot of noise.
Oh.
My question to you, Harold, is, do you find out the thing that your customer wanted to find out, or do you usually find out something else? Because I found that it was difficult to narrow it down to the thing that the customer wanted to find out.
Well, I think that's a very good question, because just last week I wrote a blog on our own website which has the title, "It's not longer about what you want to know from people. Today it's about what people want you to know." And that means that with PNI, you constantly find out things nobody wants, everybody needs. So it's that constant surprises that if a problem is complex or wicked or whatever or unknown, then PNI is one of the very good ways to find things you hope exist, although you don't know what exists, but you find things that are relevant but that you're not looking for. So and when you have a customer that says, I want to find out blah 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 blah, and it's very specific, then usually it's so you need a bit of a vague question or a vague wish. If the question, like we did with Dutch Rail, we want to know how passengers experience their train traveling from home to destination, and then they find out that there are actually positive stories and they're happy about the fact there are only 25 positive stories out of 700, they're happy. Because they already knew that there were a lot of negative stories from Twitter that says Dutch Rail is fucking up again today, hashtag fail. I mean, they already knew that, but now they know where they were failing, and they had some positive. So I should go to all the projects to find out what the real question was. But most of the time it is, we have no clue. We really don't have a clue, just give me stories. That's basically what they want first. Yeah. What happens in these trains? What happens in these hospitals? What happens in customs? What happens in football organizations on fields? Tom?
Can I ask one quick? Oh, sorry, go on, Tom, go on.
Well, I was just going to say, I was just, one bit of bad news is that the PNI project that Harold and Cynthia came to Saskatoon to help with is, the organization, it's a youth amateur soccer, is they're redoing a market study.
Yeah, sure.
They've hired a conventional consulting company. But the reason they're doing that is, in the project, they found out things that they didn't know. And part of what they found out was things that they didn't want to know about themselves. And so they're redoing the project because they don't want to know that about themselves anymore.
Too much.
Okay.
So, yeah. I mean, in a lot of the clients and potential clients I've dealt with over the years, whether it was PNI or not, is there's a confirmation that people are after. It's not new knowledge. It's not understanding. And trying to find people who really do want to understand is, it kind of helps you know who you want to work with. you can't work with somebody who doesn't want to know anything new. But overlap with that is the over-reliance on the quantitative information. If it doesn't have a set of numbers attached to it, it's not as valid. So there's a presumption of that very simple linear connection between things. We don't have customers coming in, do a satisfaction survey. Says, okay, what do we need to increase satisfaction? Lower the price. Well, it's a terrible type of interaction. But how do you describe that? That very simple linear theory that is in the back of, or that model that's in the back of people's head. Does that overlap with people not wanting to actually dig deeper and learn new information? That's kind of my struggle.
Yeah.
Tom, could you give an example of what it is that a client doesn't want to hear?
In the soccer case, I don't want to pick on them too much, but there was a drop of 40% of the number of kids playing youth soccer in that 10 to 18 age group over about 10-year period. So a huge kick. Why is that? What were other sports associations doing? Were we not advertising enough? There were an awful lot of external factors that they were looking at. And whenever you talk about the nature of the organization, it would be volunteers, which could be coaches, managers, and parents. And we would talk about the great work that coaches would put in. But, you know, that was only a fraction of them. The problems, the success of the organization depended on volunteers and parents. The damage to the organization was actually the same pool of people. It was exactly the same group. So how do you separate them out? And that is enormously threatening. And what are the internal things that we are doing that are harming our organization? There isn't an organization in the world that can rise above that on a consistent basis.
Well, what I also remember was that there was a huge difference between parents and children that were in soccer for fun and the ones that were there to become a national champion. And that divide, if I remember well, was also present in the coaches. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't a good... I'll say that, help me, I'm Dutch, a good decision or an internal vision on how to go about that from the directorate, from the directors.
That's true.
They didn't make a clear choice. We have a fun arm and a professional arm. They didn't do that.
Yeah, I actually broke it down a little bit further. There are two different dimensions. There were people who wanted to be part of the sport because of a sense of community.
Mm-hmm.
And there were people who wanted to be part of this. They wanted to get as good as they could possibly get at that sport. So I called it the development dimension and the community dimension. They are not polar opposites. And if you put the two together, they're complementary. But there are also people who were there, they wanted their kid to do better. And they didn't care one tiny little bit about what the activity was. So it could be dance, it could be music, it could be soccer, it could be football, however you want to talk about football. It didn't matter what it was. But they were motivated to volunteer to protect their kid.
Yeah.
And so in order to separate them out, you'd actually have to eliminate a third to two-thirds of your board. That was the barrier. That was the barrier. And some people clearly recognized it, but that type of fight was difficult to work its way through. So whatever that dynamic was, whether it was soccer or it's a private company or it could be a nonprofit charity organization, you can't fire directors.
Well, you can, but not in soccer organizations.
It's not easy. Those sort of change management problems are often what needs to be addressed in order to get to that point where you can deal with the information you've learned when you have actually fully engaged your community, preferably through PNI.
Yeah, and on the other hand, since the economy is at least thought to be improving, we see a tendency of more and more organizations actually wanting to know what's happening with not so much customers, but more with employees. How are they motivated? They motivated, for instance, in healthcare, in education, in customs, because there's a shortage of people. Organizations are increasingly afraid that people will leave. So we see the last 2 years, it's suddenly become easier. And in this type of projects, people do want to know what demotivates people, because first of all, it's their own responsibility, and they need to keep these people or develop them. So I think that's a difference between, say, a volunteer organization, and I wouldn't say a commercial, but at least a professional organization, that we've seen a change, or we're seeing a change. So I think it also depends on the dependence of the customer with the people that are talking.
I am going to have a meeting tomorrow with it's a rehab company. They've often been funded through insurance or workers' compensation. And it was a large movement more in the United States, but a little bit in Canada, about for companies, organizations to set up wellness programs for their staff, which is great. But they have found that the wellness programs have not improved the health or well-being of their staff. And one place that shows up is absenteeism, people coming to work. So the base idea was to introduce wellness programs to ensure you have healthy staff. You'll have less sick time, you have lower insurance costs. But they have found that that actually hasn't been the case. The wellness programs haven't been set up. I came across one article which was titled, Wellness or Health? You shall go to the gym and you shall be healthy and it'll make you happy. So it was forced upon people. But a number of the wellness programs are beginning to understand that they actually need to work with the staff a little more closely. They need to listen to the staff. And where they have listened to the staff, they have introduced wellness programs where people are much more willing participants, and they become much more, much happier in the workplace. And of course, a happier staff, it does make for a better workplace. It makes for a productive workplace. It's so, when people really do see the complexity of it, whether they recognize it or not, then the wellness programs are effective. So I want to introduce some of the PNI type concepts. into establishing the wellness program, so they actually start to have that more productive outcome. But they're only ready to listen to that because they failed in the other aspects first. So they have to try all the other ones before they actually start to say, I need to understand what's going on at a deeper level. Then I take the opportunity, says, okay, now they're available and they're ready for change. Now we can try and introduce them. That's how I'm approaching that.
Yeah, customers that are oppressed are usually more open to novelty. Yeah, we need more oppression in this world on management level.
Oppression is our key to success. All right.
You hear that, Stefan? Never do a participatory narrative theater program for managers.
I try to avoid the oppressed word. It gets very loaded. Yeah. But you're right. But I was actually interested in what you're mentioning, because I know you mentioned you do mention experiences. So experiences is quite a common. So phenomenology. So I just had listened to a lecture on research methods actually earlier today, which was really helpful from Professor David Lane, and so there was this talk about phenomenology in its pure form being just recording the experiences of someone, okay? And I was asking how you look at those experiences, and if are you looking for outliers or are you looking for common themes? And he said, sometimes it depends on what you want to do with the research. And often, and I'm just putting this out there, I think this is, P&I is quite strongly able to pick up on the outliers, and it often, textual analysis or theme analysis by a researcher tends to try and, you know, collect a number of experiences phenomenologically.
Well,
and then would look for the themes that emerge in that. And then there's this form of that which is more interpretive, which kind of tries to add some interpretation. But I don't know what your thoughts are on that, and how do you move from, like, okay, here's an experience that we want to capture fairly authentically, if that is a desire, to then maybe an interpretation off that. And in the case of P&I, obviously the participants do the interpretation on the experience. So, well, I don't know, from a would you call it a phenomenologically grounded starting point?
Well, Cynthia, I'm not sure what your experience is, but we find that in the early stages of a development of a P&I application, a project, you often find themes to narrative, to story elements, to other. So if you do your story elements exercise, that themes emerge, that researchers say, hey, that one was not in the literature. We found that in our prison thing, that there was a theme called pride, and that was never in the criminology literature. There was nothing on pride. There was a lot on crime. Be proud to be part of a gang, but people in jails being proud, that was new to them. And I think we've seen it with the theme of joy, or what was it, Tom, in the soccer thing, that a couple of things emerged that said, oh, this is fun, and they're in it for the fun, not for the the academic, no, the athletic part. Fun was much more important, and I think in early project that happens a lot, that there is in the storytellers, the respondents, there are themes that emerge early on in the project that are not in the literature or not known to the organization. So that's part one. And your other question was about the outliers. I think that happens in every stage of every project, that you find outliers in the early negatives. The only thing is, what counts as an outlier? Do you need statistical proof that this is an outlier? I mean, or are exceptions where things occasionally go wrong? Is it exceptions or is it outliers?
Well, if you take the case of pride, even it could be. I suppose you've got this idea of common themes, which seem to be okay. This seems to be a core. We're now saying this is a core. It's coming up, I don't know, X number of times across X case studies. And then you might have things which says, okay, we see that this exists, so now we see it as a factor. But presumably you're not finding it to be a core factor, because it was the factor that came up, you know, in the top three every time. That would be one of the common themes that would have already been spotted by other research methods. So you're kind of highlighting... I don't know. Does that make sense?
No. In that prison project, it turned out that the whole literature was about learning in prisons. They said it had to do with self-fulfillment, and it had to do with getting ready to go back to society, and all these things that teachers say. And the prisoners itself told stories about, I was so proud that I was sitting in this classroom discussing with professors, going to a diploma party, and I saw my mother cry because it was the first course I ever finished in 25 years after killing four people. So they were in prison for another 35 years, and they were extremely proud that they finally finished a type of education and saw their mother cry. And that was not in the literature. It was never, it was nowhere, because that sense of belonging and achieving something, because the whole learning programs were designed to with education in mind and raising good citizens, but they were never designed as building up the character of a person and feeling proud and becoming a better person in prison. That was never designed that way, but it happened.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm going to have to talk because I've been writing things down so I don't forget them, but I'm going to reach the point where I don't remember. Words mean I wrote down. Okay, so I have three things that I've been saving up. One is this, what you were just talking about the outliers versus the core, and that a lot of what happens in story work has to do with the ways the stories work and have for who knows how many tens of thousands of years. There's a certain system to it, and you have to work within that system because it's the way it works. So people use stories to explore the edges of experience, right? Nobody tells stories about making their coffee in the morning because they do it every single day. You don't tell stories about the things that everybody knows and they don't. However, what is in the edge depends on perspective. So my edge may be your core and vice versa. So it all depends on, for example, if a kid is just learning how to do something that you know really well, you're going to tell them stories about it because it's their edge, even though it's your core, right? And so this pride thing, it may have been certain people's core, but it was other people's edge. And so it has a lot to do with who's looking for stories and for what reason. And, you know, I think that when you're designing a project, you have to figure out what is the core, what is the edge, where do we want people to go? And maybe we want them to go to their core and our edge, or their edge and our core. It all depends on what you're trying to achieve in the project. So the second thing was, but should I say all three things, or does anybody want to respond to that first thing?
It sounds very interesting, Cynthia. Yeah,
what's number two?
Okay, so number two was about phenomenology. And this, again, has to do with the way stories work and have for a very long time, which is that stories are about mediating our experiences through thinking, right? So, like, for example... they say, what I've read is that the first thing that you think ever happened to you, right, your very first memory is not your very first memory, right? It's not actually when your brain started to record things. It's what you've chosen to keep, right? Because people go through this pruning process where they lose memories, you know, the infantile amnesia. But the memories they keep and they can identify as very early memories are the ones that they picked out. And so it's part of the story you tell yourself about your own life. Like my very first memory ever is falling off the porch on my tricycle and smashing into my mother's very prized Rose of Sharon tree that her father gave to her, and worrying not that I was going to get hurt, but that I was going to break her tree and she was going to be upset. Now, I don't know what that says about me, but everybody has a thing like that, that's part of your story. So what I'm trying to say is the difference between story work and phenomenology work is that in story work, we really want that mediated experience. We want to hear, what story do you remember? What story stands out to you? And when you do this in a collective way, you're getting what stands out to the community. You want to know, like, you want to work with this process of mediation that people are doing all the time, that it's not their raw experience. I mean, we say raw stories, but what we mean by that is not polished stories, but it's still a sort of processing of their experience. Whereas it seems like, from what I've read of phenomenology, you're trying to actually avoid that processing. You're trying to just get straight through to exactly what happened and, you know, almost stop them from doing this kind of mediation that people are constantly doing. But in PNI, we kind of go after that. We want that. That's why we give people the choice. We say, could you tell us about a time that stands out for you? That standing out thing is actually tapping into their processing of their experiences and trying to use that to help this emergence come out.
Just one thing on that, Cynthia, is I suppose the other thing that could happen is with the phenomenology, someone could have 3 pages of like notes from an open-ended question, which said then, so your P&I also is not, you know, it's not like you get sort of, there's a limit to how much of a story you're going to try to want to get. You want to get, I suppose, by accumulating numbers of stories, that's why you need numbers of stories, because then you there's something going on there. I don't know if it's complexity ideas, I suppose, but or a networking of ideas, but there's got to be some way that the stories relate to each other.
Well, I think there's an implied limit in the questions we ask when we say, could you tell us about a time when this happened? The implied signal in that is we want to hear a story, and the story should have a beginning, a middle, and an end, and it shouldn't take 3 days to tell it. Because that's just, you know, it's like a conversational signal. Whereas in the phenomenological interview, I assume, I'm not really familiar with this, but I assume that you go into great detail and basically follow every trail as far as it'll go, right? That you'll be like, and what happened then? And what did you feel during that? And so you're going to like really plumb each experience. Whereas we're actually specifically asking people to limit their response. And that, and people do get that. We tend to get response of a somewhat uniform length. It's not like one person talks for 1 minute and another person talks for an hour. The average is maybe 5 minutes or something. And so we're kind of setting a social context which has meaning to people because it's a cultural practice that's existed for a very long time. So,
well, I think that depends on the method of collection you use, because I recognize that when you're in a story circle, that these 3 to 5 limit that works. But if you use a story point, you get a very small responses like, "Oh, everything was okay." And you got the storytellers and all the other types you mentioned, people that think they tell a story but they don't. Mm-hmm. And you get these very long responses when the experience is very negative or positive. So I think
those are two tails of the distribution.
The
mean is generally, and when you design the form, the size of the box you give them is a social signal right there. And a lot of people will fill up the box and not much more because it seems to be implied this is how much we want you to talk. And so, you know, when you're writing things, you see that box. Like if you make a bigger box, they usually try to fill it because they feel that that's like a signal, a social obligation to fill that in. And sometimes I've seen people, when I've been coaching them on designing a form, they'll put a really tiny box to put the story in, and I'll be like, well, you're going to get really short stories, you know, with that, because that's a signal. Nobody wants to say more than they were supposed to. So you kind of have to signal to people what you want them to say by the spaces you create on this page. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of social signaling involved in the whole thing because it is a social thing.
I mean, that's one of the things with story form. When you're interviewing stuff, sometimes when I was taking stories down, you do the story and you see I was doing it about an event. You get through and he's like, hey, there's actually two stories here. So then you can sort of say, where's this? What other ones start? Can you give that one a title? Whereas I suppose if someone does a massive thing on a story form, unless you go back to them later, you don't have that opportunity because you're not actually there at the time. So,
right, yeah. Although it has been my experience that it's like 10% or fewer of people who do that, right, who kind of go on for a page or two. Most people kind of get the hint of what they're supposed to do. And the people who write a lot, there's usually two reasons. One is that they just always talk a lot, and they're just a talker, you know. You've met people like that. And the other one is that they feel that they have some great need to be heard, and here's an opportunity, or they have an agenda. But, you know, most people kind of say, okay, I get what you want. I'm going to do that. Fine, we're done. You know, and most people don't want to spend a massive amount of time doing it. So, I mean, if you look at the distributions of length of
I mean, I'm not so much about the length. I was thinking more about just that opportunity to break it into more stories. You know, I mean, like you might have three stories wrapped up together when you.
Yeah, but see, the thing is that
you can break it out as you're interviewing.
If you say, could you tell us about a time that, or do you remember an experience that, kind of that sort of wording creates an envelope that it doesn't really. I mean, some people will tell you two or three stories, but most people don't. I mean, has it been anyone else's experience? I mean, my experience has been that most people kind of get it, that you mean one story.
Right.
I mean, that's why the reasons that interviews and group sessions are so much nicer, because then if they feel like telling two stories, you can just say, okay, that's two stories. Let's talk about each one. Mm-hmm. You know, and you can just get more stuff, and that's great.
Well, yeah, normally I'm trying to break it out to get more stories in the process. So I've got, gives you more ways to then, because once it's wrapped up as a bundle, that's one unit. Whereas if you've got it broken down into two.
Well, also then when you, if you're going to ask follow-up questions about the story, which we always do, if there are two stories there, it becomes really difficult to ask a question because you say things like, in this story, did people treat each other with fairness? Well, it might be different in the two stories, so how do we answer the question? You kind of have to break it out. In fact, I've seen people where they'll see the form and they'll tell two stories, and then they'll see the questions that come after, and they'll be like, oh, that they didn't mean that. And then they'll go back and they'll like, or they'll say something like, oh, this is actually two stories, what should I do? And then I'll be like, well, here's another form or whatever. So sometimes people will actually go back and fix their misunderstanding of what was asked of them later on.
Right, got you.
I mean, because the questions that come after the story also reinforce the idea that it's supposed to be one story, because we say, in this story. So then the second story they tell, they're like, okay, I get it. You want one story, I'm going to tell you one story, and we'll move on.
Yeah, I mean, the case I was talking about, I'm sitting there taking notes, basically, on a bit of paper. So it's more like, so it's me sort of, as I go through it, sort of working out where the next story starts or.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I would do that too. Like during an interview, if you ask a question and they tell two or three stories, you have to kind of mark them out and say, okay, now let's talk about this first thing you talked about. And then you go through each one, and it might slow things down a bit. But instead of asking people the question three times, you ask it once and they give you three stories. You just say, okay, we'll do it that way. And then you ask your questions about each one. I mean, you have to be able to do that in an interview. Because if you can't, you're going to have a messy result. So I have one more thing written down here. A little confusing. It was about this issue of finding things out. And my experience has been that there's a lot of expectation management that goes on at the beginning of a project, when you're talking to people about what you're going to do together. And what I find that I do is I need to sort of test them on what they're looking for and if it's too narrow. So like I can remember one project where I was consulting with a consultant who was consulting with a client. So I was like the second, you know, I was one removed from the client. And so I'm talking to them about what does the client want? And they said, well, the client says they want to find it, like the thing that's wrong in this situation. And I was like, okay, that's a danger sign because if they don't find it, they're going to be disappointed. So we need to talk to them. And I think we had a phone call or something where we talked with the client about, you know, we can't make any kind of promise that you're going to find it, that you're going to find the solution to the problem. But what you're going to do is you're going to find out a lot more about the problem, about what's going on. And then you may get to something that is useful to you. But, you know, if you think this is, you're going to find it and we're going to fail if you don't, this isn't going to work. And so they were all like, okay, we get it. That's okay. Now, the funny thing is they did find it. At the end of the project, they actually found the thing they needed to change. But it, you know, you can't allow people to think that that's a guarantee because you don't know what's going to happen. And in fact, the reason they found it was that the guy who was doing the facilitation was just so good at it that he brought out much better stories than someone else would have. And so if we'd had an inexperienced or not great facilitator in there, we would probably have not got to it. And I didn't want to set up an expectation that we were definitely going to do that.
Well, another way to go about that is if they're very specifically interested in it, then you can also ask questions like, why can't you find it to your normal ways? And then, for instance, with an employee satisfaction survey, it finds out that the numbers don't mean anything, or they can't make sense of the numbers, and say, okay, let's then define it as making sense of those numbers, or finding new numbers that make sense. So you can rephrase the question, getting them away from it. So try to redefine the question by something that is doable.
Well, I think what we did in that case is we kind of moved it from we're going to find it, that is the answer, to we're going to find something useful. And we're not going to be so specific about what we're going to find, but that whatever we're going to find is going to be useful. And then that I felt that they were in the right place. And I've become increasingly enamored of this word surprise lately, which is that if you can get people to say, well, our result is we're going to be surprised, and that's that's the result we're going after. Then it's a little bit harder for anyone to be disappointed because they didn't have a specific fixed goal. They didn't say we're going to solve this particular problem. It means something is going to surprise us, and the surprise will be useful in some way. And I find that a good way to set up expectations because it's pretty rare that you're not surprised. I can only think of a few cases where people said they were not surprised, and they weren't necessarily in the way we set up the project. It was more of difficulty carrying it out the way we'd planned to. Sometimes you can't get the stories you meant to get. But and the other thing about the word surprise is it's a good filter, because some people, they kind of want to do it, but at the same time, they don't want to, like that particular project we were talking about, you know, where it's like, what's that from that movie, You Can't Handle the Truth, right? People who say they want to know something, but then when you say, okay, here's the questions that we're going to ask, they say, oh, no, we can't ask that. It's like, well, how are you going to get what you want if you won't ask what you have to ask to get it? And so sometimes you have to kind of remind people of what they wanted. So I find that when I say, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to be surprised, we're going to plan to be surprised, the people who say, oh, no, we don't want to be surprised, they were going to be disappointed with almost anything that you came up with, right? Because it's not going to be this buttoned-down, simple answer. And so if they can't handle the surprise in the beginning, they probably shouldn't be doing the project in the first place, you know? If they aren't willing to be surprised.
Cynthia, could I tag on to your comment?
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to speak specifically about setting up the research project. In my career, I've done several hundred employee surveys. And I'm usually talking with the CXOs in the company beforehand about what we're going to cover. And I've learned to do two things to help set expectations. One is I'll ask them what they already know
mm-hmm.
about the employees.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll ask them, is there any set of data that would make you question that?
Mm-hmm.
And my purpose is to treat what they think they know as a hypothesis to test rather than a given.
Mm-hmm.
And usually I can get them to say, well, if people said such and such, I guess I'd have to rethink it. But okay, let's find out.
Right.
So I want to dislodge that certainty and mm-hmm. translate it into something that I imagine to be the case, but I could be convinced it's otherwise if you got this kind of data. And the second thing I'll always try to do is to introduce what I think is the most important question to answer, which is, what do you not know that would make a big difference?
Mm-hmm.
And they usually hadn't thought of that. And I think that echoes some of the comments that I've heard earlier. But I have to get their expectations set for doing the research. I have to disabuse them of the fact that they already know a lot. They think they know a lot, and we may well find out they're right.
Right.
But there's some data that would suggest that they've been misled or they've misinterpreted. And then there's stuff they don't know. But I think that sets up the expectations. Most of the work I've done has been survey work, so it's been the infamous, you know, 1-7 scale. But I always do a lot of focus groups where I now realize I was collecting stories.
Mm-hmm.
So I find it's important to create the right mindset for the client in this case. The other thing I wanted to mention is that the client, the sponsor, may indeed learn a lot. But I think when I look at the way employees respond to the data and the way they behave in the focus group, they learn a lot about each other as well. And that may be more important than what the sponsor learns. They learn about the range of opinion. They learn that I'm not the only one who thinks this way. They learn that my experience is not completely unique. And that changes them. Independent sponsor learns. The targets of the research end up learning as much more.
They also learn that your boss is even a bigger asshole than mine, so I'm lucky.
And they too shall pass, so I shouldn't get too upset about it.
Right, right.
Okay, yeah. Well, this was recorded, right?
Yeah, you didn't say anything.
No, I didn't.
You blip you out.
Well...
No, but that is true. That's one of the things people do is they compare, you know, they compare experiences and they get a new perspective. That's why, you know, some people get excited about this idea that people are going to share experiences and this is going to be a transformative thing. Then, and other people are upset by that and say, no, let's go back to the standard survey because there's no such, there's no interaction in that. And there's no glow of experiences or anything.
Well, what we find the most demotivating factor during P&I projects is that it is so much work.
Yes.
I mean, a standard classical employee satisfaction survey, if you do a lot of focus groups, it's also a lot of work. But what we see more and more is they simply hand out a survey, collect 15,000 responses, run the statistics, look at the statistics, and that's it. I mean, that's becoming more a benchmark. They want to know how this company stands in relationship to the other. I mean,
by the way, I learned not to do that about 20 years ago.
Yeah, but
it's a little better nowadays. I very seldom report statistics.
Okay, well. We have this system in the Netherlands that the bonus scheme of the management depends on the average of the satisfaction in the department. I won't mention the company, but I found tens of them. But it's actually still the case. I mean, yeah. At times, I get the impression that in Europe, we import an image of how it works in the US, not how it works in the US.
Yeah,
amazing.
Well, that reminds me of the thing that I realized recently, which was that people almost universally get upset and frustrated that working with stories is harder than they thought it would be. And people always say, well, we thought it would be like magic. And I came to realize that that's not a misunderstanding of stories. It's a misunderstanding of magic. Because magic was never easy, right? I mean, if you look back at the old folk tales about magic, it was always difficult and frightening and risky and everything. And it's maybe because magic has become Disney-fied that we've forgotten that actually it never was supposed to be easy, right? And so, yes, it's magic, but it's as hard as magic ever was.
Cynthia, I'm going to have to break off, and I will add more time to all of my entries in the calendar for future sessions. Thank you very much. I really enjoyed this and look forward to talking with you all in the future.
Can I just ask you one question? Can I just ask you a quick question?
Sure.
Just one quick question. Because you mentioned about the hypothesis component.
Yes.
So if you're doing research, because that pressure that the researcher creates a hypothesis. So obviously you're going in with a consultancy, so you're kind of having a negotiation with the client.
Right.
I suppose if you have it in iterative cycles, you could have lots of probes of their hypothesis. Or do you have to start to take their hypothesis and make the proving or disproving of their hypothesis your research question, if that makes sense?
Actually, my research question, I never let them limit the research question. My client is the company, not the CXOs. So my research question is, what does this organization need to recognize and act on to improve itself? I just want the executives to realize that what they think they know may be true and may be false. So I simply promise them that somewhere in the survey, I will make sure we have data that might either validate their perception, which is useful to know, or might challenge it. The bigger question is, given everything that's going on, can we identify the it, as Cynthia mentioned? Can we find the one or two or three things that give us the biggest bang for our buck? Should we train the managers, or should we redesign work processes, or do we need to change the structure? Is our culture broken? What's the thing we need to attack, to deal with? But I always want to make sure that somewhere along the line in the data, they'll see a chance to recognize that, gee, I did understand my employees, thank God, or, wow, I missed that.
Oh, I see. So you've got like a trail of evidence on the way.
That's right.
Okay, thanks for that.
Sure. Bye-bye, everybody.
Okay,
bye-bye.
As usual. Can I chip in with something else there, or is anyone else?
I have a thing, but I've written it down. So
you've written down. Well, just one thing that came up today. I was asking some questions about the research. It was kind of how qualitative research links in, but with practice. So there's this question of like, okay. And I think it's relevant with P&I to some extent, is like, say you do phenomenological research. Okay, you're trying to find this experience, the pure experience. And then the question was, well, so how does that link to changing one's practice? I suppose you could say informing decision-making about going forward. So one of the ways that might happen is that you actually have phenomenological research, then you have an action research, which that informs through case studies. And then you might have some research to see the impact of that on work practices. This idea of, and in some ways, P&I kind of has that built into it. You know, you pass things over. You could say the sense making is a bit more the action research, or maybe the reporting is the action research. And then you're going to see how it goes. But I just wondered, how do you see P&I relating to, you know, maybe feeding into an action research cycle, or being in it, or being using it as the formation of case studies. That I don't know whether that is something that you've encountered.
Well, I guess I think of PNI as a form of action research, so that, and I guess different forms or flavors can feed into each other and support each other. But I'm not sure that, like, I think it is action research, so that if a PNI project and an action research project that doesn't use PNI want to feed into each other, then there's lots of different places where they can do that. But I think they're so similar in their goals and their methods, you know, with the participation and everything, that, I mean, there's other things that are so different from PNI that there have to be these interfaces between them, like we'll put this in this step or whatever. But I think with action research, the similarity is so close that it's more of a kind of a linking all through the cycle. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, I think I know what you mean. I mean, the thing is, one of the things I found is that hasn't really been dealt with in any of these, not so much, is this idea of the paradigm of participation. So there's this idea of qualitative research and the idea of quantitative research and mixed methods, but the paradigm of participation is big because that overlay, like Harold says, is shaping a lot of how the meaning is being generated. So, but you could have some, like a survey is, I suppose, an instrument-based approach. You could have someone who does some sort of coding of long semi-structured interviews, and then there is a question then of how does one feed into the other. It might well be that the PNI then is on steroids, so to speak, because you've done the right thinking up front, or maybe the PNI helps you to be ready to do another type of more sort of focused, like you say, rather than looking for surprises, maybe you're looking for confirmation, or maybe there's this question of surprises is very important, which is that outlier common themes thing a little bit still.
I was going to say that the way I think of it is that when you choose where to live, right, there's you have a place you live and you have a place you visit, right? That you choose that there are certain things you want around you every day, and there are certain things you're willing to go somewhere else to find, right? So in some people, like, for instance, I live in the forest, so I want trees and nature around me every day, and I'm willing to drive far to get my groceries, right? Other people want to be able to walk to the grocery store, and they're willing to drive to a park. And everybody has to make that decision, because it's pretty rare. Oh, sorry. It's pretty rare that you can get both. Shut up. Maybe she'll stop. Can you hear the dog?
Yeah, it's not a problem.
It's not a problem.
He might shut up. Oh, sometimes it's a long problem. Anyway, and so I think that approaches have that same thing, that same question of where you're going to live and where you're going to visit. And so I think PNI lives in participation less than, like, it could live in research, right, and visit participation, but I don't think it does. At least I don't like it to. I like it to live in participation and visit research. Now, everybody has their own style, and some people might do PNI in such a way that it lives in research and visits participation. And I guess each person, each project, you know, each thing might come out differently that way. And I suppose that the approach itself can kind of have enough flexibility to work in either way. But I guess I always think of it as living in the participatory element and visiting the, and that's why when I described these, what you can do with working with stories, there were 8 things and only one of them is researchy. You know, all the other ones are more people-y. Oh, in fact, this other thing I had written down to say is connected to this, which is that some people have called this kind of work pre-hypothesis.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never liked that. And I was just thinking the other day, why don't I like that? And I realized what it is. It's that instead of pre-hypothesis, which assumes that there's going to be a hypothesis and that you're preparing for it, I prefer the term para-hypothesis. A para meaning beside, like, you know, paranormal, but not really. But, you know, para means something that happens on the side of, separate from, juxtaposed with, but not preceding or following, right? Not connected in that sort of causational way, just separate. And I think para-hypothesis research, well, actually the word research doesn't really fit, but para-hypothetical, I guess you could call it, is a good description for the style of PNI that I'm going for anyway. And I would not want to say that if you do PNI as living and research and visiting participation, that you can't call it PNI. I think that maybe is going too far, because, you know, the more you limit something, then it's great for the people in the bubble, but it's a very tiny bubble. So, you know, I think that that's not a good idea, but it's good to be aware of the choices you're making and to talk about that.
Cynthia, what was that phrase you used? Para-hypothetical what?
Research, but then I thought the word research is so loaded, it'd be maybe better to call it like para-hypothetical inquiry or something like that.
Inquiry. Yeah, that's usually part of conversation is, and I think it's related to people looking for the it. I always said they're looking for the truth. They want to know what the answer is.
Right.
And if they're looking for the truth, they're certainly not going to find it. I know a philosophy professor, political science, he did ancient Greek philosophy, he used to call his students truth seekers. He used to say that all the time. And he stopped doing it because one day a former student came back and he said, remember how you called us truth seekers? Well, I found it. Which was it was religious in Oregon, but I couldn't remember which exactly what it was. But there was a truth. And quite often when we're talking to people, there's a truth that they want. They're not even looking to assess a hypothesis or even validate a hypothesis. They already know what's true. They're just looking for the material that they can take to their board, to their client, or something else like that.
Well, and that's this connects to what the guy who got off the thing, Jerry, which is that if you're not willing to put aside what you know is true and be surprised, then you're not ready to do this.
Yeah, and I know why you didn't like to say it's pre-hypothesis. I understand that full well, because what we're doing is quite different than that. Exactly. And is we're trying to actually find understanding in a lot of other ways. Now, one of the things I think you may already know that I'm guilty of is that I don't think of PNI as a certain set of methodologies, a certain set of tools or practices, because it shows up in so many different ways. And one of like the discussion you had about action research, what that triggered for me was one of my early lessons in working with clients doing a business plan. And I realized how useless a business plan was, because we did a business plan for a co-op of some form. And I'd worked very closely with the executive director in order to kind of develop that. And the way we had set it up was important that we separated a couple of functions within the organization. And it wasn't working out with the board that they have, and so their executive director left. And then all the work that I had done basically walked out the door with him. So then, and now I understand it more as the knowledge translation, the knowledge transfer, the knowledge exchange was part of that whole process. So the business plan was the object that we were calling it. But in order to have a successful relationship with the client, it really was that interpersonal work that we had done together, the activities we had been involved. And I think action research, so it has elements of that action research. So everything that I do is going to have some form of the qualitative and quantitative, just to kind of put it in that form. And I will use any and all tools that I can, but each project is going to be a little bit different. But I still can't get away from people are looking for the truth. They're looking for it. They're looking for whatever that answer is. That is consistently the stumbling block, in spite of the power of all these wonderful tools. I want to apply them everywhere. even in genomic science, I think you can actually use it there. So it's fascinating and it's fun. But in order to get people to understand that, take the time, pay for it, because it is time-consuming and expensive, and they are going to be surprised with things they don't necessarily want to know.
Trying to think of if someone wants to find it, which this is actually something somebody really said to me, is that they want to find it. They told us that. So, if someone wants to find it, what is some sort of term that you could use to move them to? Yeah, instead of, we're not going to find it, but we're going to find what? Them? This?
Well, the problem with the noun is a problem anyway, just the term it, but as opposed to a process. I mean, you've got an object, which is a very Western thing.
But
I think that you are starting from a particular point there.
Maybe insight? We're going to find insight?
Verified knowledge.
Well, I think that word insight is very powerful here. If you say, okay, we will at least find things that relate to it or that influence it or that lead to it or that kind of thing, to put more structure behind it, then it might not be complete, but at least you've uncovered how it is structured.
Well, you could use clean language for that. You could say, what kind of it is like, what kind of it, is there anything else about it, whereabouts of it, what happens just before, what happens just after, and what needs to happen for that to happen, and it's like what? That, I mean, it depends, because now you're starting to build out, because it is really a system. It is actually, like, if you... I find what's really useful, I use the Dilts logical levels. He talks about environment and behaviors, which is what you can see. And you've got capabilities and values that you can talk about, but you can't see. So I can say how, and then you've got my identity and my purpose,
that
which you can
like
only
cool.
get through metaphor.
What are you calling that? Because that sounds
That's
like Paul Laird analysis.
Yeah, it's not so dissimilar.
Okay.
They don't map across, I don't think, but that general idea, yeah, I'm not so keen on that whole iceberg thing. I know it gets used a lot. I'm not kind of 100% into that, but I know. But the bottom line is that, or sometimes it could be an alignment across all of these things. But the ability to describe the model that's being talked about, and maybe frame it in terms of an outcome or a purpose, or but somehow it's like starting at the end and trying to work backwards, like with it's like saying what we need is to make cups, and now I'm going to try and work out how do I make a company that makes cups. It's almost impossible to work out why would someone want to do that from the beginning, because you're working back from, so I don't know how, anyway, when someone talks about it, what kind of it is that, what's it like, what's it different to?
Well, in this particular project that I'm remembering, what they meant by it was they had a problem, they wanted the problem to go away, and it would be the thing that would make them know what to do to make the problem go away. So like the answer that would fix the problem, which was, and that's what that alarmed me, was that it's like, well, that's a very high standard that, you know, we're going to just...
Yeah, but it's also a how you say that, a negation of the fact that it might not exist, that there is no silver bullet that you can touch and everything will improve. I mean, one of the facts in social systems is that things relate and inter co-evolve over time. So, well, is there an it? So maybe one of the questions is, how do you know that it will exist?
Yeah.
It's a bit of a Dutch approach, being very direct. Are you sure it exists?
And if it does exist, what happens? Like, yeah. Just having the answer, it's like, okay, we've solved the problem. Harold knows the answer. It's like, but if the answer is how to fix a car, well, someone's still got to then use the answer. Something has to happen with that knowledge for it to then have that practice impact. So if they're like, so they've got a sense of like, unless, I don't know, maybe each time it has to process out in some way, but I don't know how it was for you, Tom, when you heard about that, but like what happened or what needs to happen for it to make a difference?
I think what Jerry had said is he starts his interactions with a question in order to prepare. And I'll say his client is the CXO. His client was not the organization. Technically, the work he was doing was on behalf of the organization, but it is who the people he's interacting with is how that success is going to occur. So he starts with the conversation with the CXO in order to make sure that they understand what they're trying to do in order to find out these answers. I'm going to call him para it. How's that? But Steve, I liked your comment about it being a system. And because I think that's it. That is fairly important. Because we're not looking for, as you said, as a noun. It's not a noun. It's not a particular thing. It's not an answer. It's not a solution that we can find. Once we know the solution, we can't buy it off the shelf and plug it in. In the soccer example, people wanted to know, why are we having this drop in registrations? And then we'll just reverse that. So there was a theoretical presumption. There's a presumption they knew, once we know what the problem is, we'll turn around and fix it. And I've seen that in any context I can remember. In many other places, I've seen this sort of thing. What's the problem? As soon as we know what the problem is, we can fix it. We don't know what the problem is. Okay, well, let's start measure things until we can see what the problem is. Well, we've measured it. We can see the problem. Says, okay, now we can fix it. So it's that very simple approach to how the world works. There is no recognition that it is an indeterminate system, or so much of what we do is an indeterminate system. And, you know, for me, that's the fun of understanding how things operate. And it doesn't matter whether you're making widgets or selling soccer the current one is healthcare. And you talked about customer satisfaction surveys. Is one of the my brother's going through this. He's a physician in Texas, and one of the companies they're working with is they assess their physicians on customer satisfaction. Customers come in, they've got a cold, and you tell them that, you know, it's a cold, it's a relatively minor cold, you'll get over it, you'll be fine, or go into a different physician who gives you an antibiotic and another drug, I forget what it was, they call them Copax or something else like that, which is a steroid medication. So you give them an antibiotic and a steroid, they come up, they feel better, hey, they had a great physician. My brother doesn't give as many drugs. So the customer satisfaction survey itself is encouraging. I was going to say an unintended consequence, but in some cases that's an intended consequence. And we're starting to do some of the same things in these wellness programs that I looked at. I want to take the model for the children's hospitals in the Netherlands to get people to see that, no, we want to understand the experiences at a deeper level. How do we actually make the patient outcome is what we're trying to assess, not some near-term satisfaction. Because if you just do a near-term satisfaction, you're going to understand what's going on in the system and you're going to cause other likely more harmful problems, like an overprescription of antibiotics. as an example. So I need to get to that point where, yes, we're going to talk about it, but it is a whole lot more surprising than you would have thought. It's a system. I don't know. But every time it's a conversation.
And that may be important. So really that conversation is pretty important in P&I.
Oh yeah, the beginning conversation. I think that this thing you said about the noun, that it being a noun, is really important. And I think that if I think about the times when I've had more successes, we haven't really talked about nouns. We've talked more about verbs, about like when we finish this project, we will be able to, and then we have some verbs, right? We'll be able to do these things or make these changes or, and also, Tom, it's what you said about outcome versus satisfaction. Outcome is more like a verb, more verb type of thing, or maybe an adverb. It's like, it's a state, it's a change of state versus a thing, you know, where satisfaction is more of like a thing, like an object, like I got this, right? But outcome is more like, now I can do this that I couldn't do before. Like you're asking, where do you want to go? What do you want to be able to do? Which, now that I think of it, is very different from research, like qualitative or quantitative research, which is very focused on the thing, right? It is very focused on the noun of, we will find this result. Like, result and outcome are very different things, right? And you know that for traditional research, the result is the outcome. Whereas for what we're talking about, the outcome is just incident. It's a means to the result is the means to the outcome. Whereas in traditional research, the result is the outcome. Does that make sense?
Yes. Mm.
Although action research, it can be the problem solution thing, which is also maybe a challenge but I know what you're saying. The research becomes, and that's why I think inquiry, that's why inquiry is different to research, because inquiry has a limit to its durability as a data source, potentially, which is okay because it's utilized in context. But there is actually one of the models in clean language is quite useful. It's called the PRO model, problem, remedy, outcome. So they say people get caught up in a problem, remedy, looking for the remedy to the problem, remedy to the problem. And by reframing in terms of outcome, now you've got a different way to look at things, because the remedy is always tied to the problem. So it's a bit of a vicious cycle, especially if there isn't a simple remedy. It's like you know, like Tom was saying, if there is an answer, then fine. You know, if it's put that nut on the bolt, then tell me. But when it's something that's always changing, you end up back in the problem space again, trying to redefine the problem to find the remedy, and it goes round and round and round. So, what is the outcome we want if any number of these remedies or things that relate to this problem happen to be brought to bear on it? Which is kind of like appreciative inquiry. So there's a model, I sent a link in the thing here, this is the PRO model. But they kind of use that a lot to make the clean language work make sense, because unless you're going into more of an out, especially in coaching, unless you're going for more of an outcome, if you start getting into a problem space, remedy space, that's more therapy basically. You've got a problem, you've got a remedy, is to start going into your inner metaphors in your body and try and heal them. But if you're actually going to say, okay, we are where we are, how do we move forward with that, recognizing that I might have my issues, which I do, then you work on outcomes. And I think that's quite useful.
I think that there's something in between the P and the R. So there's like, it is not any of the P or R or O. It is not the problem. Well, no, it isn't. It's something it's like PIRO, P-I-R-O. Like, there's the problem, then there's this key thing, this result, this understanding, this fact or something, And then R is the remedy that comes from from knowing that fact, from revealing that fact or whatever it is. And then the outcome comes naturally after the remedy is applied, right? So I think that traditional research is really focused on the problem and the it.
Oh, I don't want the it to exist. The it shouldn't exist. So I think people think the it is, the problem is identifiable and it can be exercised. It can be just cut out. It's a cancer that can be cut out. And so that's why they get stuck in the P and the R rather than it being that interaction or the interplay between all of the pieces.
Yeah, the remedy becomes the it in some ways. It's like I've got a scratch on my arm. The remedy is a plaster, for instance. But I've got four fingers missing. The remedy is only partially going to be, you know, I'm going to have a lot of issues that aren't going to just be fixed with something because my life's probably changed, you know. So mm-hmm. That's a bit of a weird example, but it's basically, yeah, I think people focus on remedy and I suppose that it is that remedy, but assuming that the remedy is definable and easy and blah, 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 you know, it's a thing, maybe like an object. It's the same problem I have a lot with people want theatre to be a tool or want dialogue to be a tool. And it kind of, and actually I one of the things I actually had a chat with Harold last week, I was mentioning this, is I think there's an assumption, if I have a tool, if I pick this glass up or whatever, all the things that go into what means to be a glass makers deal with. I don't deal with it. I've got it, it's a tool, I can just use it as a tool, and I just buy a better one if I want to get a better tool. But when I'm picking up a method or a process, I actually need to be working with the process. And I think one of the big problems is actually defining our field as the thing that uses tools, not the tool being used by the field. If that makes sense. So it's like P&I, because at times, like, we use a laser printer to print out story cards. That's a tool to help do P&I, but P&I is the process. But I get a sense that sometimes you go into a business or a certain consulting things. I mean, I don't know, but you know, they see P&I as a tool, like a survey, to do their thing. So there's a little bit of positioning in that. Around what the relationship between the subject, the object, and the outcome, and tools that are used in that, and that might be, I don't know if that, but and maybe that's more of a problem if you're using instruments like a survey. Maybe, you know, people are like, if you're not using an instrument, maybe they call you a process, but then they're like, they go away, say, well, I don't want that. I want a tool. There seems to be something, I don't know, would you call that ontological or about how things are being?
I think it's more like lazy. You know, it just seems easier. The way I'm interpreting what you're saying is P&I a hammer or is P&I hammering? Mm-hmm. And it's easier to think of it as a hammer. Mm-hmm. Because it's just so much more graspable, right? You can grab it and use it. Whereas if P&I is hammering, and there are lots of different hammers you can use in the course of it, it asks more of you. So maybe it seems more like a hammer when you're starting out. In when you're starting out, the thing orientation is more attractive because it's easier to deal with. But then when you achieve more mastery, then you kind of move into this, you know, thing where hammering is more important than the hammer. And then you're more focused on not what are we going to get, but what is going to happen. But maybe you have to go through that first step to get there. I mean, I think that's actually quite possible, because I know a lot of people, when they're first starting out, they're very focused on the stories, right? They're like, we got to get the stories. The stories are what we got. And they're not so much focused on what's happening with the stories, what's the process, what's going to happen to the community, what's the change in understanding or the way people are interacting and sense making and everything. That's kind of harder to kind of get your mind around. So, I mean, you know, sometimes you can think that it's not necessarily one thing's good and one thing's bad. It's more like there's different stages in how you use something. And, you know, the way an amateur carpenter uses a hammer is very different than the way a really experienced carpenter uses a hammer. To an amateur, the hammer is, it's very important, right? It shapes what they're supposed to do with it. It teaches them what to do, where eventually when the people get better at it, they are using the hammer as they can shape it. You know, and maybe they have 10 hammers for different purposes, and they, you know, they go back and forth. And if you give them a rock, they can know what to do with that in a way that an amateur couldn't. So I don't know what I'm saying, but
I'm not sure if I fully agree with that, though, to be honest, because I think that what my experience, certainly with people in universities, is like these are people who are very experienced, and they're very. I think maybe it's because they're in a different field of practice. So I think it's true, but it's experience in the other field, but they're not going to ever become experienced in that other field because that's not their field. But a lot of these things, they all want to come out. Like if you go to any of these service design conference, it's toolkit, 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 toolkit. Everyone's making toolkits, right? And it was like, and then of course the beauty was you could put toolkits on the internet. So then there was a whole business on that. And the trouble is, there's so many toolkits out there now, but no one knows how to use them properly because you need to be able to be practiced in how to use these. You know, that anyone can just take a technique that's been somewhere and just harvest all the different stuff and a literature review, make another toolkit. But again, the term toolkit, it does set things up differently. Like you don't, like if I was to say I've got a therapist, and some of them are sort of set up like cognitive behavioral therapy has gone that way. They've got a grid and then they just measure all the different things you do in your behaviors. And they start to say, okay, I don't actually care what caused your problem behaviors, but you're going to monitor your behaviors and then you're going to start to track how you can change them. And they use an instrument to do that. And of course, the benefit of that is you can evaluate that. And it's one of the only therapy methods that's got detailed evaluative data so they can prove it works. But they created the whole therapy process so that you could prove it worked, so that you could gain. They created it so it would be good for collecting data. It's kind of an irony. And it does have benefits. It does. But you're in this thing becomes a tool. And obviously the idea is there, though, that you only have trained people who've been through so many years of training. So that's the thing. It's like that 10,000 hours you mentioned the other day, Harold. It's like Harold's saw a course on forum theatre in South Africa, but unlike most courses which are like teaching forum theatre to people who've already done theatre for 3 years at university, they're doing it with people who are frontline workers. But the question is, what happens next after you've... And they're calling it... Of course, what they want to do is they want to... There's two things they do. They call it train the trainer, which is very popular. Which, what does that really mean? So not only are you going to give you a 3-day course, but you're now not only going to be able to do it, but you're going to be able to train others to do it. And it's like, what? Most people don't, you know, most people who do it don't know how to train someone else to do it. So, but you're in this really, because I think it's because maybe like you're saying, it's almost like, say I am amateurish in something or I want to keep it in the it form. What do I do? And maybe even subconsciously, I change other language around. And one of the things is tools. As soon as you see the word tool, the word it is probably sitting in the background.
Yes, yes. I mean, I also see it. I mean, I can't help it, but I see it as a sort of a yin-yang kind of thing, that yang is the active part of the thing, right? Yang is that's the it, the tool thing. It's, I see a thing, I'm going to do it, right? Whereas yin is more like water moving, right? Water can wear down anything, but if you give it 1,000 years, right? And the yin part is very receptive and sort of watching things go and working with things. And that's the harder part, because it requires a lot of attention and being receptive and paying and responding, as opposed to taking charge. So maybe people come to almost anything on the gang side, right? So they're like, okay, what can we do? How can we use this? How can we get to where we, you know, the outcome? Well, there I said outcome, but you know, how can we get it? Whereas it takes time to sort of develop the confidence to slip over onto the other side of it. And there's a balance, of course, in every project, where you don't want to go too far to the inside, because then it's all just watching and waiting, and then it's too loose to really get anywhere. I'm kind of just going off here. But what I'm saying, also, there are certain environments, like academia, is more pushed onto the yang side, because it's so competitive, and publish or perish, and it's like you can't wait to be receptive. You have to get in there, and you know, you have to make these toolkits, because I mean, there's kind of an imperative behind a lot of these things, with even the train the trainer thing, which is kind of a, in the right context, it makes a lot of sense. Like if someone already is a trainer and then you're training them, then you propagate something. But you're right. I mean, if you say we're going to train the trainer, but the trainers don't know anything, it's a joke. I mean, it's like we're just going to get this knowledge disseminated out of thin air. I mean, that's not, it's like an appropriation of a yin thing to use for a yang thing.
Exactly. It's pretty common.
Yeah. Well, there's always impatience, you know.
And the thing that actually helped me clarify this thing with the tools is there's something called the activity theory model by Engerstrom, which is kind of a form of action research. But Peter Jones said actually this page actually has
Did you say Rubenstein? Wait, what was the name of the person?
This page actually has something about it. I'll put a link here, and you can see that. And there's like a second, third generation. It comes out of the work of Vygotsky.
I typed in activity theory, and I got to Vygotsky.
You go to this link here, and then you go down. You'll see.
Say what the link is, because if people were listening, they wouldn't know.
The activity model is based on the work of Engerstrom, and I'm just giving a link out to the Center for Collaborative Action Research, which has got a few different things based on there. But it has a nice diagram which shows this model. And the key thing there is the top triangle, agent of change, which is the subject, goes to action, which goes to change, which is often called the outcome. That top triangle, at the top of it, you've got tools, basically, tools and technology. Mm-hmm. But the agent of change does an action and creates change, and you use tools to make that happen. So the question becomes is, where's P&I get placed? Does it get placed in the tools, or does it get placed in the action?
I guess I'd want to place it at a couple of different places on this diagram, but I want to say this web page. It's at http://cadres, like CADRES, .pepperdine.edu/car/define.html. Hopefully that page will be there for a while. And we're looking at this triangular diagram about, it says something about action research. I don't know. It just feels to me like it's all over the place. Like P&I is in every one of these little circle-y things.
Yeah, exactly. You can go into this in a lot of detail if you start breaking into it.
And maybe different aspects fit into the different things. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, there are, it is an agent of change, you could say. There are actions that come out of it or that emerge out of it. There are tools, instruments, and technology involved in it, but you can do it. You can sort of slot in and out different tools and technology. Have to do with rules, norms, and culture. It addresses them. It's definitely connected strongly to community and the roles and division of labor. I mean, these are all things that are involved with it.
Yeah,
I guess exactly. The things on the bottom are things that PNI engages with, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why it's partly why it's a process. So I would place PNI in the action, you see. But it does use tools, but you've got to remember, so that's the thing, because it is actually engaging. I mean, this is probably this diagram is around the unit of activity. So it says when an activity happens, it's pretty much around activity. And you can, when an activity happens, what's involved? It's not. It's a bit more specific. So when the activity of doing a PNI activity happens, you know, I think it would fit in here quite well. Actually, you could use this as a bit of a tool to speak to what's going on. But it certainly helped me realize how the tool piece comes in, and that you can have a diagram where you don't have the bottom three, like just has the top three, like the older versions. And then they've expanded it out to add in these other components. And there's actually a third generation of this now where it's all about the outcomes from different activities linking. So, but this is apparently, it seems to be used quite widely to look at activities because there's not many who do it.
This diagram, where does he place action research on it? Or is this all action research?
Well, you can use it for action research. I think that's it. This can be used as a bit like soft systems theory can be used for action research.
Okay.
It's like a heuristic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that if you're going back to this thing about the it and the nouns and the results, I think if you think about those things, you're focused more on the sort of top and bottom of this triangle and not so much in the middle. Whereas if you have more of a verb oriented, you're kind of more focused on the middle as a connector to create that change than the top and the bottom. Does that make sense? Well, like, for instance, if you take like narrative analysis, it would be saying, okay, we're going to pay a lot of attention to these things along the bottom in a sort of fact-finding way, right? We're going to tap into them and learn about them. But they don't want anything to do with this whole agent of change action thing in the middle, because they're not about change. They're about learning and about, you know, proving and finding things out. Yeah, it's funny because I had put this thing down of finding things out, and I realized the word things is right in the middle of it. So this is very thing oriented, right? This is a very thing oriented, and actually this is probably not the greatest fit. I mean, it works, but it doesn't work as well as some other things for PNI. At least that's been my experience.
That yeah.
If people really care a lot about the finding things out thing, they're less happy with what the outcome. Whereas if it's one thing they want out of several things, then...
Well, what this could be useful for is you go to two or three people and you could say, okay, you want to do it. You would like me to be able to help you with it. Where do I... Well, if you saw this big diagram, even if you took away the... didn't include the bottom bits to start with, and you say... Mm-hmm. Or maybe you did. You just gave them this. You just get rid of all those arrows and you just say, how do you see me fitting in here, and where do you see yourself fitting in?
Well, if I think of taking this to clients that I've had for projects that we've done, I can say that some of them would look only at the bottom three things and say, I want to tap into these things, I want to learn about these things. They take the middle and nobody wants the top, right? The tools, instruments, technology, they don't care about that. They're just like, whatever works, you just do it. I don't care. But so some people are be really focused on the bottom. It's like, yes, we want this. But then there's other people who would be really excited about that middle thing, about the change.
Yeah, well, that's what you're there to do. But see, what people would like you to do is, so the bottom bit's messy. The nice bit is like, I've just got this nice shiny tool. I put it in the top of the pyramid and bang. I mean, that's kind of how SenseMaker's kind of placed to some extent. You know, I mean, like, I'll just tell you you've got the tool. You don't need to worry about that bit. And it's all going to pop out the other bit.
That's what I always disagree with.
But isn't this a nested discussion? Isn't it that sharing a story for a participant is almost, yeah, of course that's an action, but it can also be a tool to express yourself or to make yourself heard, or, and I think in a sense, the whole P&I methodology or approach or method or whatever you call it, can be a tool in a bigger organization to achieve a certain goal, such as change or finding things out. Or so I think it depends on the level of the organization if something is a process or a tool.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. So you're saying some clients, some people would be more interested in the tool part of the thing, as here's a thing we can use to achieve what we want, and these other things are not so important to us.
Yeah, I think if you look at that whole child and hospital thing, then they looked at P&I as the process, the tool that could bring the voices of thousands of parents and children to life, because they were never there. So they saw it as a tool, but they also saw the process behind the tool, because that meant more information on doing the work of the foundation well. So I think it's very easy to switch from tool to process to goal to, and maybe they all relate. I mean, in that sense, a story point can be a tool for somebody to share a story that they really want to share. And from the process perspective, that's a collection tool. Yeah.
I could imagine using this triangle to show to people and say, okay, if you just look at all these things, which of these things like jump out at you as like, that's what I want. I want this part of it and the rest doesn't matter so much to me. That you get a variety of different responses. And I think it'd be really fascinating to do that.
Well, I think it would be even better to say everything in this diagram is achieved by P&I, some people don't want change to become part of the project, but it happens anyway. So which do you want to minimize or not involved with or stress, or do you want to increase the sense of community, or do you want to get cleaner roles, division of labor, or do you want to minimize change, or do you want to test this method as a tool? That's also possible. And they're not interested at all in rules, community. They're just interested in how does it work. I mean, it's okay. I don't like that kind of project, but it can happen.
Well, I guess it's a question of what do the things on the bottom mean. They could mean that you're just finding out about those things, and mm-hmm. they could mean that you're changing those things.
Exactly. Or are you testing a tool to find out if you can discover rules, norms, or culture?
Right.
Because you're unaware. I mean, I really like it.
On this diagram, there's no element of, you know, information or learning.
Well, rules, norms, culture, roles, that's of course, yeah.
I mean, you have change and action, and you have these things mm-hmm. that there could be change and action in, but there's nothing to do with discovery or, you know, no. revelation yeah. or information.
Mm-hmm.
I can yeah. imagine that some people would look at this whole thing and say, I don't want any of this. I want to find out something. It isn't on here.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, this is a diagram for action research.
Yeah, but actually, can I, one thing that's interesting with this diagram, actually, I think I found there's a new way that seems to. This is where strategic action fields can actually work beyond, can do some things. This is okay if you're working in a very design orientated way. So for me, I would almost see doing P&I as the story is the tool to help me do the P&I, and the P&I is the process because I'm drilling it down. So I think you can reconfigure this diagram in many different ways. But the one thing, the feedback I got from Peter Jones, actually, when I told him about this, because it seems to be they use it a lot in design research. He's like, oh, you found that, did you? But it was kind of like, he said it's really hard to use unless you go into it really deep and you want to work as your unit of analysis. I mean, this is good, I think, as a heuristic. So I actually disagree with him because I think I wouldn't necessarily go off and do a whole research project based on this. But as a heuristic where I want to have a conversation and talk about like we're doing now, it's pretty handy. But the unit of analysis is activity. But sometimes we're not, like, we're talking not necessarily about an activity of like, doing the same thing over and over again, using maybe, unless you're doing story collect, maybe that can be useful for when you collect the stories in a very particular activity way and you want to compare an activity against an activity. But if you're looking at more processes, if the unit of analysis for what I'm looking at is maybe a field of practice or maybe stories or maybe how people engage in a workshop, then this would be more like, how do I use a tool for an activity, you know? But it is quite relevant in the case of P&I, because if someone comes along and places you somewhere, whether they say it or they don't say it, it has implicitly framed you and your work, whether you like it or not. So it's, I think it's kind of useful in that way. I didn't want to. I didn't want to sort of sidetrack us, but I thought that's quite useful.
But there is a level in some organizations where a whole factory is a tool just to produce new cars, and it's an outlet. It's a plant. It's a, how do you say that? What do they say? Is it a
production line?
Yeah, I was more talking about a location. We got 12 locations to make cars, and there's a whole human activity system there with the logistics and the whole thing. Mm. And they see it all. Oh, we need a 13th factory. For them, it's a tool. So yeah. I think it depends on the level. I think the work by Herman Dooyeweerd, is a famous Dutch philosopher. He created a whole hierarchy of value systems, where you start with the eternal and you end up with the kinetic aspects of atoms or something like that. The whole universe is over there. And I think on any level, a tree is just a tool in growing a forest.
No, I disagree with that. I don't think you can use it where there's an ecological perspective present. I think it's possible with, like I used to do, when I used to work in the print trade, so I was a print buyer, like to buy in stuff from different, so I would see, you know pretty much that you go somewhere, they got a six-color press and they got this, that and the other, and you basically plug and play, because every printer has got somewhere that prepares, somewhere that prints, somewhere that, and it's the same everywhere. And actually, mm-hmm. Look at it now, it's been commodified so much that it's pretty much start to end computer. So something like that, if you're making widgets and you just need to know, shall I put it in this plant or that plant, and if I know that it meets my spec, then it would act as an activity hub. But when you've got something like, I'm trying to look at a milieu of production, or I'm trying to look at something which is more of an ecosystem, this is probably not, you know, apart from as a discussion tool for like what we're doing now, which actually has fairly rapidly picked up an idea of it, I think it's best to be kept at the level of activity. Keep it as a tool for looking at how activities break down. And then it's kind of useful.
Actually, I think what's neat about this diagram is that it can bring out different perspectives. So like you could take this and you could say to people, can you give an example of a tool or a technology that has been part of your work or your experience or something like that? And you might get a whole bunch of different answers. Or, you know, can you give an example of an agent of change? Or that the way that people see this thing might be very different. And it might be good for a planning kind of thing in that you would expose these differences in perspectives. You know, because when we were saying, oh, well, this is a tool, oh, no, it's not. You know, it's like, wow, that's a good conversation to have if you're planning something. Because
maybe you can even story collect and have metadata being how someone fills in.
Well, we are having a lot of discussions lately with customers. Some of them seem to think that we are the developers and software people that deliver story points and story dashboards. And we keep on saying, well, that's a part of the process. What we do is we do P&I cycles and we do an iteratively, that's a difficult word for me, in order to help you gain more insight and make better decisions. That's what we do. That's the core of our, and that we in every step develop the story point a bit because a new team arises. And we develop the dashboard a bit because the time scale improves and we need to redesign it a bit. That's another level. So talking about tools, they saw the story point as a story dashboard as the two tools we were delivering to them so that they could do P&I. And we said, well, sorry, these are just the tools we use to help you do P&I cycles. and that's always the difficulty of having some examples on your website. You get very easily confused by, oh, these guys deliver software.
Right.
And then we say, how can we ever make a living on $100 software that's impossible. We are, look at the program, look at the proposal that we made. It's full of activities.
I think you have to kind of put the software in the back.
Exactly.
Not let it creep into the front, because it wants to creep into the front, because it's that whole thing about the hammer being graspable, right? It's easier to see the hammer than the hammering. And so you have to kind of work to communicate.
Yeah. But on the other hand, you use the knowledge of the customer and its language, the knowledge of they have, for instance, the language the participants use to review the story point. So the story point, the story form are always very important in the project, because you work on it in a participatory fashion. And before you know, the story point is the end product instead of a tool in the bigger process. Yeah. And there's an awful lot of work going into the story form. So we now make story dashboards. The first thing we present is the steps, collection, sense making. That's the first part of the story dashboard. Because they said, this is the process we support, and this dashboard is in that step, and that's all. Yeah.
Interesting. Well, it is 4:02 on my clock, so.
Yeah, it's.
Stop. Because it's a long recording.
And it's getting dark and cold over here.
Yeah, I can hardly see you.
Well, that was really useful, guys. Thanks for everyone's input. That was helpful for me.
Yeah, me too. It's really interesting. And thanks everybody for coming. Sorry, Tom?
I think the one thing I learned is that the first stage in any good project is to do some hammering of the client.
Oh, dear.
Very true.